Hello and good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, the year 2000, and in the Creekside room this morning, Deanne Lagerquist continues her session called by Our Inheritance, Neighborly Responsibility. So now it's time to go to the Creekside room for Deanne's session.
For both of you, my name is still the same, Deanne Lagerquist. Just that ever irritate you, people say, for those of you who don't know me, my name is, I think, and for the rest of us, what is your name? My name is Deanne Lagerquist. This is the third in a series on vocation, cleverly titled In Order to Relate to the Summer Theme, called By Our Inheritance. And this session is called Neighborly Responsibility, with that funny set of initials underneath, which I have stolen from a chapel talk at Luther College, which I did not hear. But Mike Blair, the campus pastor at Luther, told me about this chapel sermon by one of their seniors a few years ago. This woman said, obviously in response to the "What Would Jesus Do?" bracelet, she said that she thought that there should be another alternative bracelet with these initials, WWIDIYWJ, which stands for, what would I do if you were Jesus? And that's one way to get into the discussion of vocation, and particularly vocation and the way in which it turns us toward our neighbor. And that's what we're going to talk about today. I'll do a little bit of reviewing, and then we'll spend some time talking together about the things that are not job, okay? Because yesterday we talked particularly about job or work. I'm using job there in a kind of mushy way to include any kind of employment and some other stuff. So we'll talk about what else there is in that circle of life, and then I have some other things I want to say at the end. I'm going to try and say less than I said yesterday when I went on and on and on and on, so we'll see how that goes. Because at Holden, group gathered shifts from time to time. Susan and Paul arrived yesterday from Kentucky, and Gertrude here today. And I want to read again this Billy Collins poem that I read the first day when we just spoke abstractly about vocation. Billy Collins is a poet I became acquainted with listening to Terry Gross's Fresh Air. I don't know if any of you listened to that show. I used to before the radio in my car died. And one year during a poetry month, she was interviewing Billy Collins. He is a little irreverent sometimes, but always giving a twist that gives you a new way to see things. So this poem is called One Life to Live. This is the only life I have. This one in my head. The one that travels along the surface of my body, singing the low voltage song of the ego. The one that feels like a ball between my ears sometimes, and other times feels absolutely galactic. The life that my feet carry around like two blind scholars working together on a troublesome manuscript. This is the only life I have, and I am standing dead in the center of it, like a man doing a rope trick in a rodeo, passing the lasso over his body, smiling inside a twirling of ovals and ellipses. This is the only life I have, and I never step out of it, except to follow a character down the alleys of a novel, or when love makes me want to remove my clothes and sail classical records off of a cliff. Otherwise, you can always find me within this hoop of myself, the rope flying around me, moving up to encircle my head like an equator or a halo or a zero. Seems to me that when we talk about this theological concept of vocation, as I said yesterday, it's one of the theological concepts it's impossible to keep in the abstract. Right? We can talk about it theoretically, but if you talk about it in any robust, meaningful sense, immediately you begin to apply it to this one life you have to live, right? And what sense to make out of that circle that we're in, except once in a while, right? The more I read this poem, the more I like the way Collins gives us these two instances of a kind of ecstasy when we get out of ourself. And I'm wondering, even if vocation, maybe that's one of the ways that vocation comes to us. How is it that we break out of our circle and hear something of what we're meant to be? When I talk with students, that's the vocabulary they often use when I think they're searching for vocation, what I understand to be vocation. What am I meant to do? There's a kind of, well, it borders on essentialism, which I talked about, the danger of essentialism in vocation, saying there's one thing, and that there's this true self, if only I could figure out who I am, I know what I was supposed to do. There's a danger there. But there's also something true about the way in which following our vocation is right. There's a rightness to it. Luther uses the organic metaphor of a fruit tree. A fruit tree gives fruit. It doesn't make a choice, but it just happens. Or what was going through my mind this morning in Bible study is that old camp song about, I've got a river of life flowing out of me. Like, what do? When you have a spring of living water? Right, I'm going to keep it all inside. That's the dynamic of vocation. I got a river of life flowing out of me. I can't keep it in. All right. Let me stop from that rambling and try to say more succinctly, as by way of review. I think I'm following Luther and in his lineage of the reformers, what I understand to be going on in vocation. It's a process like this. Once we have been embraced by God's gracious love, that's where it starts. So we're talking about in Bible study this morning in Galatians. Once we have been embraced by God's gracious love, once we have experienced God's deep acceptance of us, of who we are. I have this quote from Luther up here. God has commanded us to put our whole trust in his mercy and with utter certainty and without any doubt to have faith that we ourselves and all our works are pleasing to him, not because of our worthiness or merit, but because of his goodness. This is where we start. Yesterday, I had these two columns. Those of you who were here will remember, but they didn't give me a blue one, so I can't do it so beautifully as I did yesterday, where I had the blue column of how we are before God, and in faith before God, we are made acceptable. Right? And we image that in all different ways. The summer theme has we put on the cloak of Christ. We used to talk about that in baptism. That's why we have that tradition of the little white robe for the little baby, is to put on the cloak of Christ. Right? Now, my son had a red blanket because I wanted the spirit. You know, that the spirit comes inside. But that's where we start. Once you have been embraced by God's gracious love, that's the first movement. The second movement, once, if we go back to the river of life, this water has been poured into you, once you're filled up with this living water, then go from the embrace God has given you and turn toward your neighbor. So think of it as a dance. I know I'm mixing a zillion metaphors all at once. But once you have been embraced, can you hear the square dance caller? Now turn to your neighbor. Don't turn in on yourself. Peter and I were talking about this. That one way of thinking of vocation is the absolute opposite of being curved in on yourself, which is one definition of sin. Once you've been embraced by God's love, turn towards your neighbor in love and serve. Let that water flow out. It's It's really quite a simple idea. Very simple. But it's one of those things, like Merton says somewhere, that keeping a journal taught him that he learned the same things over and over, but deeper. And this is one of those things. Once you've been embraced by God's love, turn towards your neighbor in love. So that was the green column. I'm always doing this with my students too. I go and point at the chalkboard where it used to be written. Okay? But if this is the before God, where there is faith, then the next thing is toward neighbor with love. We also talked about the time element here, that this is the eternal, this lasts forever, and this is the temporary or the temporal. These are coexistent. It's not like we have this now and then we'll get that. We have this now and we have this. So we talk about vocation being a way of living. No, Christians and Jews have this notion that time is going somewhere. It's not just the same damn thing over and over and over in a circle or even in a spiral. Sometimes it's messy, and when we talk about vocation, that becomes really clear, you know, that maybe this line is kind of like that, but it's going somewhere. And vocation is what comes, it's the way we live between Jesus' resurrection and our own. So this part goes in there. All right. And so I would say, what is our job? Here I'm using job, not as employment. What is it we do between Jesus' resurrection and our own? There are two primary things. Two primary things that happen once we have been embraced by God's love. And one is that we return praise. We say thank you. Right? Don't we teach our kids that? We almost make it reflexive. Someone gives you something and it should evoke gratitude. It should, you know? That we see life as a gift every time someone says, thank you. Not because it wouldn't come to us otherwise. I love that in the explanation to the Lord's Prayer. When Luther says, we pray not because God wouldn't feed us otherwise, you know. God would feed us. That's very important for vocation. We return praise. We are grateful. One way we do that is in worship. But the other way we return praise is by service. By using the gifts. In my family, I think I said this already in one of these sessions, in the Lagerquist family in which I grew up, whatever you get for Christmas, you have to immediately start making use of it, right? So there you are, the Christmas pictures. You've got on this new Holden Village sweatshirt and a beautiful new linen skirt and some funny hat and oven mittens, right? You got to put it all on right now. Start using it. The way you show your gratitude, and in this case, what you have to use, the gift, you use for someone else. Because if you just hold that water inside, it's going to grow. All right, so give the water to someone else. Okay, so that was by a little bit of review about what I mean by vocation. Let me see, what else did I want to say about that? Just to lift out then the other thing I talked about, that vocation, when we apply it to job, two, we talk about origin, the origin of the call. And I've been saying there are three kinds of call. There's the call to salvation, that's the being embraced by God's love. And then there's the big C call, which is to witness to that. And then the multiple callings. So the origin is God's action. And then to use the gift in service to the neighbor. So that's the outcome. The danger, the great temptation when we talk about vocation is that we say that the outcome gets confused with the origin. That turning to the neighbor becomes the vocation. The vocation is the call. The vocation is the voice. The vocation is the gift that God has given us and then sends us out. All right, now where am I? Good. Now, back to the circle. Yesterday we talked about job. Work, often employment. We had up here a whole bunch of words like career, trade, profession, all these words we use for that kind of stuff. And sometimes we get paid for it and sometimes we don't. In our society, we give a particular particular value to things we get money for. And vocation offers a critique of that. Right? Why do you do it? Lee Hardy says, well, of course, livelihood, but also personal satisfaction and also making a difference. Right? So vocation offers a critique. Do I do it because the money is good? Am I willing to do it if it's not? All right. But now, for today, we have this circle, this rope that Billy Collins talks about in his poem, circling him, the circle of myself. And it's, you know, that, how does that, is it 24/7 or 7/24, whatever it is you hear people talking about now? Vocation is that. And it's 52 weeks a year. The clever thing is no vacation from our vocation, right? It's not just in our job. So let's say this is the job. What kinds of relationships and responsibilities do we put over here? Let's just fill it up. Quick, what else goes over here?
Sleep.
Sleep, yes. Some of us make that pretty big.
Coffee.
Okay, now do you want coffee here to stand for socializing? Or for
relaxation.
Okay, relax. Sleep and relax. Okay, Carol.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's... You got this.
We socialize. We have friendships. Family. Okay.
Domestic chores.
Right. And those are often of the type that we were talking about yesterday with Lee Hardy and his, this really good book by Lee Harvey's a philosopher at Calvin College, The Fabric of This World, is a great chapter in which he, down and dirty fashion, goes through the way people have thought about work from the Greek philosophers forward. And he says, the Greeks thought about much of work as being analogous to being an animal. You know, you work so you can eat, and then after a while you die. Right? And it's just the same thing over and over and over and over, and I clean the house, and then tomorrow it's dirty again, and Rick washes the clothes, and next week they're dirty again, and I get the car fixed, and it breaks again. And it's just the same thing over and over, and it's just like being, the Greeks say, like being an animal. Domestic chores are like that!
That's Burckhardt's theory of history. This is the one thing I remember from seminary. Burckhardt's theory of history is one damn thing after another.
And then it goes nowhere.
It goes nowhere.
And then it goes nowhere. But remember, I used to have this little line up here that says it does go somewhere. Okay, what else goes in here?
Exercise.
Okay. Which is taking care of your body, which the Greeks, some thought that was good, you know, the gymnasium and all of that, but the philosophers really wanted to get past the body, right? To be able to contemplate, to get to the spiritual things. But I'm going to leave it here because I think that's really important for our understanding of vocation. Again, back to the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread. Luther expands that to mean all those mundane things. Bread, bath water, clothes, friends, all the things that are necessary for life. What else goes here?
Worship.
Worship. Okay.
Entertainment.
Okay. You might also add there then the arts.
Hobbies.
What?
Hobbies.
Hobbies. How about some responsibilities?
PTA.
PTA, good. That's great.
Oh my goodness. Civic duties.
Civic duties, all different kinds of civic duties. So I'm going to write citizenship. Yeah. We're beginning to touch on the various categories of things that we do, activities we're engaged in, and relationships that we're a part of. Part of the brilliant insight of the 16th century reformers, and I keep saying that because Luther was really important in this, Calvin had some things to add. So we tend to, as Lutherans especially, to go to Luther. And if you read about vocation, everyone starts out with a little chapter on Luther. It's one moment at which, as Lutherans, you can be proud. We get noticed, right? But unfortunately, we haven't been very good stewards of this teaching. We're getting better at it. But I lost my point. Where did I start? Okay, yes. Luther helps us to understand that vocation takes in the whole of life, all of our activities and all of our responsibilities. Probably when we began to understand vocation, it's easy to think about our job. Okay? And in the popular use of the term vocation, that collapse happens. I'm looking for a vocation, which means I want to have a job that's meaningful. Or a job, where's that? Simone Weil. It's over here, I think. Simone Weil says, I saw that carrying out of a vocation differed from the actions dictated by reason or inclination in that it was due to an impulse of an essentially and manifestly different order, and not to follow such an impulse when it made itself felt, even if it demanded impossibility, seemed to me the greatest of all ills. There's a kind of passion, right? And 20-year-olds are really looking for that. And I don't want to demean that. I mean, how wonderful. How great to feel that passion that everything you are can be used in a way that makes a difference. That's great. We should all be so fortunate. But the doctrine of vocation, the teaching about calling, does not guarantee passionate engagement. Okay? If you're, you know, sometimes, but I gotta tell you, sometimes it's hell.
Have you used my favorite Luther quote yet about the doctrine?
No, we haven't gotten to that yet, but pretty soon. I saw you come in and I have in mind to call on you at that moment.
All
right. Okay. The point I want to make from that, it's not always passion, is that here we have what Luther calls orders of creation. Those of you who have been going to dance sessions know what one of the dangers of the orders of creation are. That we talk about government and family and church, those are the three Luther particularly talked about. These are the orders, the organizations, the channels through which God works to preserve life. Now, the problem in Germany for many, not all Christians, but many Christians, many Lutherans, is they said, well, God works through the government, and my job as a citizen, the way I live out my vocation, is to do what the government tells me. Huh. Very dangerous. Very dangerous to confuse the outcome for the origin. God's intention is to preserve and continually create and enhance life. But the containers are always imperfect. Okay? Now, even acknowledging that these are imperfect, I'm not willing to throw them away. You know, to say, oh, well, it went really wrong in Germany, so we got to get rid of that orders of creation business. Or to say, as many have, that there's a, if you look at the household codes in the later Pauline corpus, you know, the husband should be like this, the wife should be like that, the children should be like that. It's all nice and neat. I don't know what family the writer of that was from, who had such a nice, neat, who was probably an aspiration, not a description, right? That's been used in a very oppressive way that doesn't take into account the gifts that God has given us to give to the neighbor, right? It says, oh, don't let that water out in that direction. Ooh, you're not supposed to be giving water to those people in that way. Sorry. So I know these are dangerous and they can be misused, but that's the way life is. Everything can be misused. And if we're afraid that we're going to misuse it, we'll never use it at all. We heard the parable of the talents, right? So I think the orders of creation, we got to recycle them. We got to reconsider how those are helpful when we look here. Okay, Luther didn't really have a job, partly because he lived in a, it was just emerging as a cash society. He did talk about the shoemaker, right? And the milkmaid, we might say those are jobs. So all of these we could probably categorize somehow. It has to do with civic life, family life, or public life, and domestic life would be a nice general way to put these together. And vocation is significant in these. We're always trying to figure out how to do that well. And to this end, I want to just say one more thing about that and why that's important, how it's related to our anthropology. That's what we talked about last time. This is a quotation I did finally write down. Where did I put it? Here, Sam Portero, who's the Episcopal Campus Chaplain at the University of Chicago. In a book on campus ministry, he writes this, the meaning of one's life is derived from relationship. The relatedness of oneself as an individual to the whole of life is invitation to an ongoing conversation with all that constitutes the other. That one's life is a response to a call is the basis of vocation. That one's life is a response to a call from God is the basis of the Christian concept of vocation. The vocational conversation extends through the whole of life, not only life's length, but its width and its depth. Yesterday we talked about the relation of how the way we understand what it means to be human issues in how we understand work. Okay? So if you think work makes you beastly instead of godly, you'll probably diminish work. Dorothy Sayers, who emphasizes the way we are made in the image of a creative God, says then we look for work that allows us to manifest that gift which is in all human beings of creativity. For some, that's artistic. For some, it's creative in human relationships, right? It also gives her a way to say some work, you can make it meaningful in this doing it on behalf of your neighbor, but it shouldn't be done, right? There's work that's just bad work. And one of the ways we serve the needs of our neighbor is to say, that's bad work and nobody should have to do it. We got to figure out another way to get screen doors than that way. or else we got to do without screen doors. Okay, so then what Portero is saying is not only are we creative, but we are relational. Okay, so when God embraces us in love, of course, we turn to one another. What are the ways we turn to one another? We turn to neighbors who are close to us, our family, and we turn to neighbors who are a little further away, right? And that's the public sphere. Okay. Now, is this making sense? Are there things you want to say about it? Ways you want to expand on it? Okay, then let's keep going. So, that means we are busy with many things. This is the Martha part of our lives. Right? We are busy with many things. The history of the interpretation of the Mary and Martha story is fascinating. Just fascinating. And it's interesting that in the 16th century, the Protestants break from the interpretation that seems most obvious in the text, in which Mary is the one everyone should want to be. And they said, you know, there's something to that Martha stuff. And we began to think of the two sisters being inside of us. We are all both Mary and Martha. And the Martha in us is important. Oh, I erased it. For this time. Right? Somebody has got to make the coffee, or there won't be any. Right? So it's all nice to be upstairs praying.
Who's the great theologian of the, I think he was slightly ahead of Luther. And maybe it was even earlier than that. It may have been 14th century, where there was this great Mary and Martha, Martha cult, if you will. And then what they said was, well, Mary has chosen the good part, and that's only part of it, though. But Martha really has it all together. And she's the complete woman,
yeah.
And it was just because Mary wasn't mature enough to have taken it.
Yeah.
She had to kind of wait on her, but Martha has it all. And I can't. That's in that wonderful little book about the women around Jesus,
yeah.
by Fiorenza.
Wow. Okay. So the many things that we do, Luther says, are masks for God's work. Now we tend to think of mask as a negative. You know, to say I put on a mask, I'm hiding. But a mask, we also want to think about a mask as it gives, it makes it visible. Okay? Doesn't make everything visible, but it makes something visible. They're temporary. These things that we're doing, they're temporary and temporal, but they're important. Yeah, the PTA is not forever. Yeah. It's not forever. It probably is not forever because I expect there won't be PTA in eternity. And it's not forever in your own life. But when it's your turn, it's really important. Okay? Similarly, being a parent at least changes. Right? It's not forever in quite the same way. A job is not forever. Despite, I read yesterday at Ellen Goodman column about Charles Schulz, who died when the last, you know, strip came out. A job is not forever. None of these relationships are forever. They're all doings, not beings. These are also all ways that God preserves life. PTA, yeah. Right? Being a dad, yeah. Being a policeman, yeah. All of them are there for the preservation of life. They also all have a killing edge. There's a way in which these things are related to the cross. They're meant not just to preserve life, but to restrain evil. To restrain evil. How should I put this? Well, the government, right? The idea of the government is that it's supposed to both restrain evil and help good. I teach at St. Olaf. I'm always having this response in faculty discussions when we're trying to make rules about things. But what we want, some of my colleagues seem to think that if you get the right rules, everybody's going to love each other. I don't know where they got this idea. I said to my department chair recently, the problem with you is you are from one of those liberal Protestant denominations where you think everyone is good. If you were a Lutheran, you wouldn't be so surprised. But I give you what we want. We want the rules, the orders of creation, the organization of our vocation that, one, restrains us from doing bad, and two, helps us to do good. It's like a cast, right? It's on the one hand trying to keep you from moving your leg the wrong way, and at the same time, helping it to grow back the way it's supposed to be. All right.
I think one of Carol Kinderly's comments was that in heaven there will be no need for preachers or policemen.
Very nice. Very nice. Now, Luther talks about to come out of the public sphere into the domestic sphere, marriage as a school of character. Right? You keep finding these parts of yourself that you thought were really good that they're maybe not so good. I'm a very forthright person and fast. I make decisions quick. And I act and I say what's what. And I've learned, being married to Rick Dunning, that sometimes you gotta go slow. And sometimes it's better to go slow. And sometimes it's okay to wait to say something, and maybe you don't really need to say it. Right? This is a school of character. Same way, being a parent, this is your cue, Franz.
My favorite Luther quote. When I rinse out the dirty diapers, the angels in heaven sing.
Okay, now that is not fun.
That was a suppressed quotation of Luther.
Right. It's not fun.
No.
Right? There's not much ecstasy in that part of being a parent. So that's the other way it kills. That if you will, the old Adam that wants life to be all happiness and joy, learns that sometimes using your gifts well in service to others, that's the satisfaction you're gonna get. The origin is so important. Having been filled up with the living water of Christ, it has to go somewhere. And some days that just, it's not that fun. I just spent 2 years closing an academic program. It was not fun, I can tell you. Although, we did some pretty fun things. And frankly, for me, that was an important realization that one of my gifts was to be able to say, okay, well, let's have a New Year's Eve party for the ultimate year. And I came to school in my sparkly outfit. No. I went and bought all that confetti. We did New Year's Eve resolutions. And for a moment, we had fun. But the process was not fun. But it was good. Right? It was faithful service to those students who were entrusted to me by my office. And that then brings me to the next thing, which is that we talk, the vocabulary of Lutheran theology, we use this word office or station, where we stand, where we are placed, what casts we have on, if you will. And to the American mind, that sounds constrictive. Oh, your station, your office. It allows us, I think, one of the good things, if we can realize that they're not unchanging, that's the first thing. Gotta say, there are a lot of stations on this train, which is my journey, and right now I'm this station and that station. is that they give direction and structure to our acting. What am I to do? I can do anything. Luther says, all of these are worthy. What am I to do? Well, where are you today? Who's next to you today? There's a station. And frankly, for me, if I can use myself as an example, I hope it's helpful and not self-serving. You know, how did I respond to that closing had a lot to do with my station. It gave direction. It gave structure. Everyone has these. The difference for Christians is not that we have stations, is that we don't confuse the station with our identity. Okay? We don't confuse the channel through which the water goes with the water, which comes from God. Okay? So that's the other thing that I learned more deeply was, yeah, that's my job. And it's the way I can use what God has given me, but it's not me. And if someone says something nasty about the way I did something in my station, that's fine. That's fine. Because that's not totally me. It's a tricky thing, this putting on the robe of Christ, right? Putting on the costume, putting on the mask of God. Right? I'm going to have to go do a hard thing. It's kind of scary. Do you ever do that? You have a really kind of a big day at work. It's going to be hard. So you put on your lucky underwear, right? Remember, I took my PhD exam, so I had special underwear. Nobody knew inside. It was just at that time they had those Maidenform ads, the woman with the business suit and red bra. You know, so I was like, oh, I can do that too. I'm going to have special underwear when I take my exams. No one will know, but I will know. In a way, that's what this calling business is. No one has to know, but it's there. Except sometimes we do have to speak. All of this vocation business, in a way, is acts of love. This is for the order of creation. God preserves life. This is temporal. It's an act of love. It's not about eternity. It's not salvific. It's, you know, it's just life. But sometimes, rather than letting our actions speak for us, once in a while, we've got to speak for our actions. So someone will say, well, you're a really busy person. You've got a high-status job. You have a beautiful young family. They need your time. What are you doing coming down here to the battered women's shelter one day a week? Why are you doing that? And that's when you have the chance to explain your action. Or when someone said to me, how did you get through these 2 years? This is a little offhanded. But I said, well, you know, odd combination of chapel and murder mysteries. Right. But the chapel part was having an opportunity to give praise back and to be reminded that in the office, what I bring to the office is what I've been given. Right? It's what I've been given.
What do you make of the fact that the church as a whole tends to use the word office only for the office of ministry and not for the office of other vocations?
Oh, that once again we have succumbed to the temptation to confuse the church with the clergy. Yeah, I think that's part of it. And it's also because, you know, when I did, I don't know if you were there, Carol, the day I talked about the call to salvation, the big call, the callings, and you won't be surprised to hear that this is where I put clergy. It's the second subcategory there. No, it's a particular job, and it's a really, 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 really important job, because how are we to know that we have a vocation? how are we to have words to understand that? Someone has to teach us. And I'm sorry, people are getting you frustrated. That's your job! But it's also my job. No, I'm a teacher, it's my job. One of the ways I do that is the first time we talk about grades in my class, I'm going to be very clear with you what a grade means. A grade is about a single piece of work. It has nothing to do with whether your roommate likes you or anyone will ever love you or you will find the cure for cancer or achieve world peace. It's only about this piece of paper. And it's not even about what you know. It's only about what you told me you knew on this piece of paper. Right? That's what I'm trying to do there is kind of in a sneaky way tell my students about vocation and about identity. And then all of this comes into this kind of a formula where who you are, being, leads to doing. Not doing leads to being. Franz told this great anecdote yesterday about a guy who thought he was going to find his true self. So he starts divesting of everything, right? Clothes, books. I would have kept the books pretty closer to the end, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Clothes first, artwork, dishes, house. Oh, car, I would have given that away real early. I know. And what is this poor guy down to? A pile of pornographic magazines. No, no, no. What I want to be down to is my little shell, my little baptism fetish. I'll be clear, yes, it's a little fetish. And actually, it's one of the things I did in the last 2 years. For a long time, I had two fetishes. One is a Tree of Life pin, and the other was a shell on a blue string. And then the string broke. And that's the problem with fetishes, they break, right? And I had to replace the Tree of Life pin twice because I kept losing it. But my students knew about that pin, and so when I lost it, I had to go get a new one because it mattered to them that I wore that. Okay, being precedes doing. That's the key here. Now, Carol, I thought maybe you were going to take me to what's the last point I want to talk about, which is the relationship between individual vocation and corporate mission. Because so far, everything I've talked about is individual. And we have to ask, where's the church in this? Where's the church in this? 3 points I want to make about that. 1, the church has a responsibility to teach about vocation. To give us these concepts. Lutherans, not only, but strongly among American Protestants, have until recently resisted the revival-inspired impulse to make Christianity anti-intellectual, to say that ideas don't matter. Ideas matter. We are thinking beings, and ideas matter. And this concept matters. It matters. Now, it can't stay a concept, can't stay an idea, but if you don't have the idea, you can't apply it. Okay? So, one way the church has to be in this is to teach. To not get stuck on, now Carol will know who I'm quoting, one of our teachers who used to say, so, now that you're not going to, don't have to do anything, what are you going to do? I would say, so now that you can do anything and you must do something, what are you going to do? Right? You must do something. Faith compels love. And love must act. And frankly, who's the other Luther one? Is it over here?
Palmer's here. Gilgun?
No, is it? Or maybe, oh, here. See, as no one is without some commission and calling, so no one is without some kind of work. if he desires to take heed, to continue his calling, look to himself, faithfully do what is commanded, and serve God and keep his commandments. Then he will have so much to do that all the time will be too short, all places too cramped, all resources too weak. And what do you mean you don't have a vocation? Unless all you do is sleep. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, however many years God is giving you. What do you mean you don't have a vocation? So the church needs to help us think about that by giving us good understanding of God's intention for the world. First of all, what does God intend for the world? And then how is that made specific in my case? What God intends for the world is wholeness, fruitfulness, right? Life. And that's what I like about Gail Godwin in her novel, Evensong. If you haven't read it, I've read most of Gail Godwin. I think this and The Good Husband, which is about a woman dying from cancer, these are her two best. This is a novel about an Episcopal priest. And at that point, it's from her fiancé. She gets a letter from her fiancé when she's trying to decide whether or not to be a priest, and she says, "Is it my vocation?" He writes back, "Something is your vocation if it keeps making more of you." Right? If it keeps giving more life. And I would want to add, to you and to others. Not just to you, but to you and to others. The Frederick Buchner thing everyone loves to quote about vocation, where your great joy meets the world's great need. As long as you understand joy there in a profound way and not a trivial way. So that's the first. Teach about vocation. Second, equip people. Don't just tell them, help them. That means, in part, using those gifts, drawing them out. And that we can do some in our congregations. You know, it's seeing the kid who could be a pastor, who's 10, and taking special pains, right? Saying, well, here, let's have you do this, and let's have you do that, and to give a channel to the gifts. But it's also seeing the widow who suddenly has a gift of time and a great deal of love, and doesn't know where it's given, right? And to help that widow know what to do with all that love and all that time. Okay? You can multiply the possibilities. You can do that in a congregation. The church at large. Well, I teach at a college. Why does the church support a college? Well, I think for this very reason. For this very reason, to equip people to use their gifts. Your congregation can't teach someone microbiology, but your congregation's funds that support St. Olaf or Luther or Texas Lutheran can. We're not so good on some of the other, what we call, trades. We could be better. We could be better. And then the third way I think the church should be involved in this, or has to think about how we are involved in that, is the question of corporate action. How do we act together? And I'm not going to go there right now, just simply to say it's there, because we have only 6 minutes and I have gone on and on and on, and you might want to say something.
Well, I think when we talk about volunteering and holding, when I tell people what that is, you're going to work with the mundane. You're going to sort garbage. I don't care if you've got 2 PhDs. You're going to use your talents in many ways. You know, but that's an example of what you've got to give. And if we don't have both, we're going to have chaos.
Yeah.
If we don't take care of the garbage, it's a mess.
Yeah.
Somebody has to do this, so we're all involved.
Yeah, and Gertrude, I'm so glad you reminded, because I did want to say this about, I think one of the great wonders of Holland is the scale.
Right.
So that here, we see the relationships with our neighbors are really clear. It's very easy for me, even in a small town, you know, I don't know where my food comes from. I don't know most of the people, although I had a great incident this spring when I didn't pick up the flowers on time. called up my friend, "Who owns North Fold Floral?" She said, "I can't remember, but go down to the hardware store. Lee Lansing will know." And then I went into the hardware store and I asked John, the plant guy, and he said, "Oh, that's my wife." But at Holden, that's the norm. So if you set off the fire alarm, well, there you see the people whose other work is interrupted by your setting off the fire alarm. All those relationships are highly visible. And it's a good opportunity for us to be reminded of those neighborly responsibilities that get attenuated in the rest of our life. And also to remember that there are various kinds of gifts. One of the things I think is really very instructive about Benedict's rule is that on the one hand he says, use people's gifts well. He doesn't say it quite like that, but the part I love is he says, pick a reader who can read. Right? And since I'm a reader who can read and I can't sing, I'm particularly fond of that section. Pick a reader who can read. There are certain things that you need the skills for, and then there are other things like garbology that everybody can do. And those you pass around. So there's both parts there. Both parts.
Well, then everybody should have a piece of the chores.
Right. But it's also, you can think about this with voting.
Yeah.
Not everyone should be a legislator. Right. Or a governor. And sometimes people shouldn't be get to be because other people don't exercise their responsibility to vote. Right? So there's both kinds of things that go on in those orders of creation. And also there have to be people who sometimes say, this isn't working. Oh, I've spewed forth so much water, you're choking. Tomorrow morning we're going to talk about decision and discernment and decision making, because of course, as I said, the real problem is, especially for people like us, who have the resources of time and money to be at Holden, it probably means we also have other resources and opportunities. So for us, the issue about vocation is not so much how is what I'm doing made meaningful, but how do I decide what to do? Okay. Vocation is the answer in both cases, but they're very different situations. The one, how is what I'm doing made meaningful? And how do I decide what to do? So that's what we'll talk about next time. Okay? We're very close. I could read you a little bit of Dorothy Sayers, if you want. Or you can leave. But I have this set of readings up here of things that I have found helpful. And one that some people find a little surprising is this murder mystery called Gaudy Night. And, it's kind of long. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. But she has an encounter with an old classmate who's gone to live on a farm, and they're discussing whether or not she should have done that. And here it says, "I'm quite too prepared to admit, a plowshare is a nobler object than a razor, but if your natural talent is for barbering, wouldn't it be better to be a barber and a good barber? And to use the profits if you like to speed the plow, however grand the job may be, is it your job?" "It's got to be my job now," said Mrs. Bendick. "One can't go back to things. One gets in touch and one's brain gets rusty. If you spent your time washing and cooking for a family and digging potatoes and feeding cattle, you'd know that that kind of thing takes the edge off the razor. You needn't think I don't envy you people your easy life. I do. I came to Gaudy out of sentiment, and I wish I'd stayed away. I'm 2 years older than you, but I look 20. None of you care in the least for my interests, and yours all seem to me to be mere beating of air. You don't seem to have anything to do with real life. You're going about in a dream. But it's a beautiful dream in a way." It's an easy thing to say. Vocation is, once you have been embraced by God, you turn towards your neighbor in love. But Mrs. Vendrick finds that having turned to someone, at one point she says, sometimes you, you marry into someone else's job. And that's what she said happened to her. She fell in love. She moved up to the farm country, right? So there's also, we may want to talk about this a little bit next time too, there's also a way in which these things impinge upon each other. Right? Vocation doesn't solve everything. One of the ways I've noticed this now that my son gets a little bigger is that he gets up in the morning one day and he says, Mom, are you coming to the carnival at school this afternoon? And I go, what carnival? What carnival? And I have to say, I'm sorry, I'm in charge of a meeting this afternoon. I can't come. No, I can't do both things. So that's kind of what we'll talk about tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to leave those up so that if I have to move rooms tomorrow, I can use the same table.